All right, welcome back to the Indiana Wildlife Federation podcast. My name is Quentin Collins, and I am your host today. Today, I am very excited to have who I think is one of the most distinguished guests that we've had thus far, and likely will continue to hold that title as we move through these subsequent podcasts. We have David Mizajewski. He is a naturalist for the National Wildlife Federation. David, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, Quentin. I'm doing really well. Really thrilled to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for carving a little time out of your busy schedule. For our listeners, you may have seen David on some much larger publications than our humble little podcast. He has been on shows such as Conan O'Brien, bringing out animals and explaining their significance and their unique needs to the listeners. And with that being said, David, the question's incumbent upon me: how did you get involved in this role? How did you get involved in NWF? Because what you do happens to look like a dream job for a lot of folks.
Yeah, well, I'm the first to admit that I have a really cool job. So my title is naturalist. A naturalist is really just somebody who has a love of the natural world and who studies it and who kind of, enjoys being out in nature and that kind of thing. But then, at least for me, I think it's also an important piece of being a naturalist that you are able to be a communicator about it and share your love and your knowledge of the natural world with other people. And for me, I always hope to be able to do that in a way that inspires them to want to get involved in the conservation of wildlife in the natural world. And so in my role as naturalist at the National Wildlife Federation, most naturalists are, working in places like nature centers and zoos, which, I have my background, that's kind of how I first started out in my career, or national parks or places like that. And so I do my job as a naturalist for the National Wildlife Federation largely in the media. And so I'm actually about to celebrate my 22nd anniversary at the National Wildlife Federation.
Oh my God.
And so if you rewind, I actually joined to run what we now call our Garden for Wildlife program. This whole idea that we all have an opportunity to make our own piece of the earth, our own yards or garden spaces or neighborhoods, a little bit more natural and kind of connected into the local ecosystem. And, started in the year 2000, doing that, that sort of urban ecology thing is something I've always been interested in, and ended up writing a how-to book on how to create a wildlife garden, which then landed me in front of the TV cameras hosting an entire series called Backyard Habitat on Animal Planet, the TV network. We did two seasons, 47 episodes of that show. And once I started doing the on-camera stuff, it just kind of grows and spirals from there. So as you mentioned, nowadays I'm still doing a lot of media work. I've hosted things on Nat Geo Wild in addition to Animal Planet. I've done appearances on pretty much every show and network talking about animals and wildlife and nature, History Channel, Sundance Channel, HGTV, you name it. I do regular appearances on the Today Show, and I used to do the Martha Stewart Show all the time, Conan O'Brien, Wendy Williams. A lot of that work is bringing on what we call wildlife ambassadors. These are animals that live under human care, and we're able to work with those animals to kind of represent their wild cousins and help inspire people to want to do something to protect the animals that are actually out in the wild. So it's a pretty wild job. I also do a lot of blogging and social media, and I recently launched a YouTube channel during the pandemic because I couldn't be out on the road when everything was locked down. So I've been doing a lot of stuff on YouTube. So lots of stuff going on there, but that is kind of in a nutshell is my job. I try to inspire people by teaching them about nature, telling them about the National Wildlife Federation and our affiliates like Indiana Wildlife Federation, and just get people jazzed up about getting involved.
And I think then you confirm my suspicion. It certainly does sound like a dream job. Wow, that sounds amazing. And, I have to ask, obviously, you've done all sorts of different interviews. It sounds like, this harkens back all the way to, to 2000. What was it in your professional background, be it your college experience, et cetera, that, what were kind of those natural steps that got you to that stage?
Well, whenever I get this question of how did you end up with this job, I have to go back to the beginning. And really what it boils down to is that I am a born lifelong nature geek. Probably like many of the folks that are listening right now, I just, ever since I was a little kid, loved animals, loved being out in you know, in the woods and the fields where I grew up. And I was really lucky to have parents that let my sisters and me just kind of explore nature on our own term. And we spent a lot of time as kids just, you know, I grew up in suburban New Jersey and just ran around in the woods with my friends. And I climbed trees and I caught frogs and, you know, I got bruises and scrapes and covered in mud and poison ivy all the time. And, you know, would catch snakes and bring them home and freak my mother out and all that kind of stuff. And so that experience as a kid, having access to nature and an ability to kind of just kind of run around and play in it in an unstructured way, you know, we know today, and it's actually a big part of the National Wildlife Federation's message in our kids in nature space, how important that is to developing a love of nature in, you know, for adults, you know, and that's kind of at the core of what we call like the conservation ethic, right? And so for me, I kind of feel I was born this way. And then I had this great experience as a kid where I was allowed to explore. And then I just, you know, I was a junior naturalist at my local nature center and I read every book on animals that I could. And I watched every nature program that was out there. And, you know, ultimately I went to Emory University down in Atlanta and, you know, was shooting for a bit kind of like a liberal arts degree. I knew I didn't want to go sort of into the hard sciences. And I ended up doing a program called Human and Natural Ecology, which is really kind of like an environmental studies program. They just called it something different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just kind of a 360 degree look at all things related to conservation. So I did take science courses like conservation biology and courses on energy use and things like that. But I also took courses like religion and ecology and history of the environmental movement in the United States and environmental communications and things like that. And, you know, at that same time, late high school, early college, I picked up a book called Noah's Garden, Restoring the Ecology of Our Own Backyards. And I read that book and it kind of was one of those light bulb moments that you have in your life where you're like, oh yes, this is the thing that just makes so much sense and gets you so impassioned. And the book essentially was about how, again, all of us, you know, we live somewhere, you know, a lot of us have yards, garden spaces, or even if you don't have your own yard, you know, there's community gardens and there's, you know, sort of green space all around us. If we just look, that if we plant certain things, if we kind of restore the native plants that grew here for, you know, centuries and millennia that the wildlife need, you know, and I'm talking about the butterflies and the songbirds and the pollinators and things like that, we all have an opportunity to make a personal action that actually has an impact on wildlife. And it really is this idea of the relationship between plants and animals. That's what ecology is, right? And so anyway, I read that book, it blew my mind. I really got into this whole idea of gardening with native plants and restoring habitat for wildlife and made my parents rip out their front yard landscaping and all that stuff. And you know, got the ecology degree, which I paired with political science at Emory. And moved up to DC and did a bunch of different things and eventually landed at the National Wildlife Federation.
Oh man, that certainly is a long path. And you know, I think we certainly share a very similar childhood, as I imagine many of our listeners do, and just, you know, being very, very fortunate to have folks looking after us that are able to recognize that passion for the environment, passion for wildlife and all natural things, and not, you know, take you and cram you in a room, make you do your schoolwork and stuff and say, hey, go out there and explore, catch snakes, catch frogs, get covered in poison ivy. You know, it heals.
But exactly, yeah. And let me tell you, a really great way to learn to identify plants is to get covered in poison ivy so bad sometimes that I would have to like stay home from school because my hands would be so swollen. I got it so bad once in winter and I couldn't go on a family ski trip. So that actually fueled me to pull out some botany books and field guides and try to figure out what the heck, you know, what does it look like? And eventually I was like, oh, so that tree that I've been climbing in that is covered in those thick, hairy vines, you know, with leaves of three. So that's the rhyme we say to kids, leaves of three, stay away from me. And hairy vines are the itchy kinds, right? I learned that firsthand from that personal experience. And that's a powerful lesson. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a powerful lesson that I've unfortunately learned myself. I've exact same experience in the terms of I was just kind of rolling around in it, didn't really know what it looked like, and then wondering why I was swelling up a day later. Yeah. So, yeah. Unfortunately, I think, I share that with you as well. I think the first plant I learned how to identify was poison ivy, sheerly out of self-preservation more than anything. And, you know, you talked about, you know, how it sounds like, you know, the roots of your involvement with NWF really almost kind of go back to the backyard garden program. And, you know, I know that's something that a lot of our folks here in Indiana do, is we have a lot of people that take a lot of pride in their gardens and just kind of, you know, the residential areas. And, you know, they go through the effort of actually getting it to become an NWF certified wildlife habitat. You know, of course, you know, we have some listeners that have already done that. We have some listeners that are in the process. But for the folks that are thinking, well, what the heck is a certified wildlife habitat? What can you tell me about that? You know, what distinguishes just a regular backyard from one that is conducive to wildlife?
Yeah, so I'm going to start with a somewhat shameless plug for my book, which is called Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife, because it's a how-to book on exactly that question. It will walk you right through, you know, the kind of the concept, like what is a wildlife habitat garden? How do I create it? What do I need to be thinking about? And it's a National Wildlife Federation book. You can buy it from any bookseller, and a portion of the proceeds go right back in to support the conservation work. So it's kind of a win-win. But, you know, to break it down the basic components, look out your door, right? You're probably not living in the middle of natural habitat. There's probably lawns and pavement and, you know, if you live in an urban area, you know, lots of buildings. If you live in a rural area, you know, maybe giant farm fields that don't have a lot of natural habitat. We human beings have radically altered the landscape and the environment wherever we choose to live. And that's true, you know, to varying degrees all over the globe, no matter what your culture or society is. And unfortunately, you know, for kind of most cases, we humans change the landscape in a way that is not beneficial to other species, right? Or maybe just a handful of species, the pigeons of the world, right? And so when it comes to taking that personal action for wildlife, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we can get involved in conservation. You know, we can let our voice be heard. We can become, you know, kind of more of an activist and get involved in policy issues and legislation and things like that. But, you know, we can also do these personal actions, and it all of it's important. And so the whole idea is that the way we landscape in America is pretty bad. It might look pretty, but it really is providing nothing for the local wildlife. And that is because what we've done is we've kind of completely removed all of that native vegetation. Again, the plant species that co-evolved here right alongside wildlife over huge amounts of time, and that are the plants that the wildlife need to survive. They're the plants that the pollinators rely on. They can only feed on the pollen from certain plants, or the butterflies that can only, their caterpillars can only eat the leaves of certain plants, or the plants that birds need to, you know, find food or nesting areas and so on and so forth. And so by putting in our lawns and our pavement and our ornamental non-native plants that really don't support any wildlife, we've whole scale reduced the value of much of America to its native wildlife, its indigenous wildlife and plants. But, and this is what a garden for wildlife is all about, we all have an opportunity to change that. And it's pretty simple. It's just picking the right plants. And the good news is that it's a totally different, forgive the pun, landscape today than it was back 22 years ago when I first started at the National Wildlife Federation. Today, it's much, much easier to find good native plant material, you know, that's commercially available. You can buy it at your garden center. You know, there's a lot of mail order programs nowadays, and get those right plants that are going to, again, look beautiful and be functional. You know, I'm not talking about just letting your yard go wild with weeds, right? You know, you can deliberately create these landscapes that are appealing to us, but also support wildlife. And in fact, the National Wildlife Federation in the last year, we've launched our own native plant program. It's a mail order program. It's designed to make it simple. We have done all the work. It's a curated line of native plants in kind of collections that you can, you know, purchase through the National Wildlife Federation. We will deliver them to your door in recycled packaging. You'll get garden plans. You'll get information on the plants so that you can plant them out in your yard. And, you know, you don't have to, again, do all the research and be a naturalist like me to know that, you know, this particular collection of plants, you know, is going to support 36 species of native wild bees and 20 species of butterflies and moths. We've specifically picked the plant species based on what the science tells us is the numbers of wildlife species that are going to benefit from it. So it's a really, really neat program, and it only recently launched. We're expanding it. This is going into be our second year, and I believe Indiana is on the list for this year. So folks can check that out. If you just Google Native Plant Program, National Wildlife Federation, you'll find it.
Oh, well, I can tell you right now that that's going on my list of things to do, as and I'm sure I share that with many of our listeners as well. So, you know, for example, I'm getting ready to purchase a home here in the next couple of months. And, you know, that's certainly something I want to do, is make sure that, you know, the way that I'm kind of handling my yard and the way that, you know, I'm approaching, you know, just my day-to-day life, not only reduces the negative impact that I have on our wildlife and the natural world, but, you know, I also want to try to do whatever it is I can to have a, you know, a explicitly positive impact. So, you know, I kind of almost view it in two camps, you know, reducing the harm that we do and also increasing the benefit that we provide.
Yeah. And this is the perfect way to do that. You know, it's simple, it's fun, you can get the whole family involved. And, you know, when you plant these native plants, the way that they help wildlife, again, is that they're going to provide that core habitat. And habitat, really, if you break it down, is made up of four things: food, water, cover or shelter, and then like the places or the resources that species need to reproduce and raise their young or kind of get the next generation going. And those are the four things that we talk about with the Garden for Wildlife program at the National Wildlife Federation. And in fact, that's how my book is broken down too. And so you plant the plants, they do three of those four things. They're going to provide food, natural sources of food in the form of, you know, seeds and berries and nuts and fruit and sap and nectar. In some cases, yes, the foliage of your leaves will get eaten, but that's okay. The native plants are adapted to it. They're not going to die if their native pollinators are feeding on their leaves like the caterpillars. But the plants are also going to provide hiding places from predators, places to get out of the bad weather. You know, and that's like a more of a garden design thing where you plant the good native plants and then you plant them densely, kind of like what Mother Nature does, right? Not just one tree plunked in the middle of a lawn, you know, a big tree with understory trees below that, and then shrubs below that, and then wildflowers, you know, and you have these layers of habitat and dense plantings. So that's going to provide that cover element. And then the fourth one is places to raise young. So birds, where do they raise their young? In nests that they build in the branches or the cavities in trees. So plant more trees and shrubs. Where do butterflies raise their young? They need those specific caterpillar host plants. So plant those, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So really the plants do three of the four components. And then you just add a water feature like a bird bath. And those are the four things that any space, whether it's a big, huge, you know, multi-acre ranch to a typical quarter acre suburban yard to a little postage stamp urban yard, even if it's like a balcony garden in containers or a rooftop garden, you can provide those four elements in some way, shape or form: food, water, cover, places to raise young. And you mentioned certified wildlife habitat. So within the National Wildlife Federation's Garden for Wildlife program, we have a recognition component. And that's what certified wildlife habitat is. So if you provide those four very basic elements of habitat in natural ways, plant native plants, put out a natural water feature, don't spray pesticides, you can get that space recognized as a certified wildlife habitat. You know, I'm not going to show up with a clipboard and judge you and, you know, fail you. You know, the whole idea with this program, which, by the way, started all the way back in 1973. So we've been doing this for a long time. And the whole idea there is to really kind of positively reward people for taking those steps and to give them that reward, you know. And so when you get certified, you get a certificate and you can name the garden space that will appear on the certificate. And you get a unique habitat number and you become a National Wildlife Federation member, get a bunch of stuff with it. And you can also purchase one of our yard signs that you can stick out in your yard that says, look, I've done something really cool. And the sale of those signs too also goes right back into our program so that we can continue doing this work. But that's what certified wildlife habitat is all about as part of the Garden for Wildlife program. And Indiana Wildlife Federation is one of our affiliate partners. I know you want to talk a little bit about the structure of the National Wildlife Federation in a minute. You know, a national organization with state affiliates, and Indiana Wildlife Federation is one of them. And a good number of our affiliates are active partners with us in the Garden for Wildlife program. So it's definitely a great way to get connected with, you know, your local conservation organization like Indiana Wildlife Federation and be part of this bigger national movement that the National Wildlife Federation has been doing for, you know, almost 50 years now.
Oh, absolutely. And certainly, yeah, certainly want to talk about, you know, a little, the unique structure of NWF and, you know, how Indiana kind of ties into setting NWF's agenda and, you know, how NWF similarly kind of helps guide Indiana, both, you know, somewhat at a local level, but also more so at a national policy level. So, you know, what can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how NWF works with its affiliates?
Yeah, so the National Wildlife Federation, we oftentimes get confused for other organizations, the Panda Organization, World Wildlife Fund, that's not us, we're National Wildlife Federation. No, they do great work, but we at National Wildlife Federation, like our name kind of suggests, we're kind of America's conservation organization. A lot of the other big wildlife groups are focused, you know, on wildlife issues all around the globe. And we focus our work, for the most part, at the National Wildlife Federation here in North America. And so that's something that kind of distinguishes us, hence the name National. And we got started all the way back in 1936. And the whole seed of the idea that resulted in the National Wildlife Federation was, if you kind of like rewind in your mind with me, go back to the, you know, to the 30s, this is a time where in America, there really wasn't a lot of, there really weren't any protection legislation for natural resources or wildlife. And so as a result, as you know, we were coming out of the Great Depression and kind of the sort of the tail end of the Industrial Revolution and all of that, you know, we had done quite a number on this planet. You know, pollution was rampant. Hunting and fishing was not regulated or managed, so a lot of it ended up being unsustainable. There was huge demand for, you know, bird plumes for fashion, and just wholesale killing of wetland birds, for example, the decimation of the bison population here in North America. Everybody knows about the passenger pigeon, which actually went extinct. And so there was this effort that kind of was led by a gentleman named Ding Darling. He was the founder of the National Wildlife Federation, and he was friends with Roosevelt and got permission to essentially pull together a convention of all of the people in America that had some connection to our natural heritage, to our wildlife, to our, you know, our outdoor spaces and things like that. And so Ding Darling kind of convened this meeting in Washington, D.C. and invited everybody that, you know, he could think of that was interested in these things. So hunters and anglers, you know, sort of sportsmen who were at the core of the conservation movement, they were there. But it was also people, you know, sort of in the burgeoning kind of hiking and camping movements, and bird watchers, and even, you know, gardeners and people like that were all there at the very beginning. And they came together and said, hey, we have to stop this. We got to turn this around. Species are going extinct. We need to do something about it. And out of that meeting, the organization, the National Wildlife Federation, was founded. And we took that model, and that's kind of how we organized ourselves. So that we're a national organization, and today we, you know, we're headquartered in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C., and then we've got offices scattered around the country. And, you know, those are all sort of national offices that are operating, you know, in different regional spaces. But, and this is what makes us a federation, we have what we call a state affiliate, of which Indiana Wildlife Federation is one, in each state and territory in the U.S. And what the affiliates are separate, completely individual nonprofit organizations that share the mission of protecting wildlife and conserving our natural resources. And as you can imagine, every state, you know, the states are different in America, right? And so there's this tremendous diversity of organizations that have affiliated together under the umbrella of the National Wildlife Federation to collectively support and share kind of our shared love and value of protecting our natural heritage here in America. And, you know, so we've got very, very kind of eco green groups focusing on things like climate change and wind energy and things like that. And then we've got very traditional conservation organizations, hunting and fishing groups. And think about that for a second, especially in today's day and age with the political climate, where it just seems that no one can get along. You know, at the National Wildlife Federation and with all of our affiliates, there's a real commitment to, you know, agreeing to disagree. Like, we're not going to agree on everything, but we all know that it's a really important American value to kind of save and protect our natural heritage. And we all can come together focusing on that shared love. And that is hugely powerful. So for example, you know, we have an office in Washington, D.C., and a lot of work in conservation by necessity is focused on policy and legislation and making sure we have good, strong wildlife and conservation laws, you know, and we have a huge impact when we do that. So to be able to, you know, help bring in folks from our affiliates and go to their elected officials' offices and be a convener of that kind of, you know, really grassroots wildlife conservation effort makes the National Wildlife Federation kind of unique because of that structure. And it gives us a lot of power. You know, the National Wildlife Federation's membership is equally sort of divided between political parties, if you will. And, you know, we try to keep this as nonpartisan as possible, because again, we all are, you know, we have this shared natural heritage, and it's going to be up to all of us to come together, however difficult that might be, you know, and do it. And that's what our affiliate structure really is special for. It really helps achieve that. And, you know, beyond just that, the affiliates are part of our organizing structure at the National Wildlife Federation. So affiliates meet every year and help set the conservation agenda for the national organization. And our leadership structure is based on our affiliates. Affiliate members, you know, kind of make up much of our board of directors and so on and so forth. So it's this really kind of holistic, sometimes, you know, very complex and complicated with all these different groups. But at the end of the day, I mean, again, we've been at it for, you know, we're closing in on a century, you know, another couple decades, we'll hit that mark. So it's a pretty special organization. And probably the fact that I've been there for 22, 23 years is a testament to what I think about the National Wildlife Federation and our affiliate. So,
right. Well, and you know, I certainly would reflect your sentiment, you know, in terms of, you know, the modern political climate, you know, of course, we're, you know, it seems that conflict has just become more and more commonplace. And, you know, regardless of if, you know, it's a red state or if it's a blue state, if we're even going to give them labels, I think that, you know, conservation issues and environmental issues are very unique and almost inspiring in the sense that it's not very common to see bipartisan support for issues. But I do notice that bipartisan support seems to be a lot more common in the environmental space and in the conservation space. You know, of course, we all have an interest in making sure that the world that we live in is taken care of. And not to say that, you know, that can't be, you know, compatible with, you know, industry practices or what have you. You know, we can still prioritize conservation goals and without it being, you know, an exclusive option. You know, those, you know, we oftentimes talk about conservation versus industry, and, you know, those don't have to be mutually exclusive. They can work with one another.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's really all case by case, right? And there's so many different strategies that conservation organizations can take, you know, and sometimes it is working with partners, right? And bringing together coalitions and compromising and all of that. Sometimes it is more of an adversarial approach. And sometimes the stick sometimes is the only tool that's going to be effective to make some of this stuff happen. And so it's, you know, that's where I think the experience of a group that has, you know, just the history that the National Wildlife Federation does comes into play, because there's so many different ways and strategies of doing this work. And, you know, I think, again, we've got a really nice long track record of being involved and, you know, in many ways, oftentimes not the spotlight, you know, because we are this federation. You know, a lot of times the work that the National Wildlife Federation is doing is behind the scenes, and it is building the relationships and connecting, you know, the folks on the ground, whether it's a state affiliate or state wildlife agencies and things like that with, you know, other partners, and kind of the end goal is what's important. That's to get the work done to protect and restore America's wildlife.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I think you touched on, you know, one of my, you know, favorite kind of components of National Wildlife Federation and, you know, even, you know, at IWF being on an affiliate is, I think one of the, you know, the big benefits of NWF being a federation is that network that it provides. You know, oftentimes, to your point, we oftentimes have conservation groups in state A and state B, and they don't realize that what they're doing is affecting one another. And I think that, you know, NWF provides a really great form for, you know, states of a particular region to be able to work with one another on, you know, cross-border issues, you know, whether that be, you know, invasive carp species or invasive plant species. I know that, you know, different affiliates have all come together to kind of get on the same page, prioritize those goals, and draw up action plans so that, you know, each of the affiliates can go about, you know, can go about taking certain action steps that are going to help out their neighboring states. Can you share with us any sort of success stories that you're familiar with in that regard?
Well, I mean, there's things that immediately come to mind. Currently, one of our big pieces of work that we're doing across multiple states is work to reintroduce bison to their native grassland habitats. And we're doing this work largely with tribal partners, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and some of our affiliates. And so, you know, the bison, we mentioned this a few minutes ago, were largely wiped out. I mean, it was down to something like 100 animals left in Yellowstone after somewhere between 30 and 60 million of these animals used to roam America's grasslands. And again, across multiple state borders and things like that. And for a whole variety of reasons, we wiped them out. And so today we're working, for example, with the Eastern Shoshone tribe on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming to bring bison back to that land. And again, we have a whole tribal partnerships program that's happening in a few other places as well. It's amazing. Like, I can say this because I'm not directly involved in this work, but like, holy cow, how amazing is it to think about that, like restoring this ecologically and culturally important species to its original native habitat, right? I got to see the first bison calf born on that land in 132 years. Not, I didn't see it actually born, like drop out of the mother, but I saw the first one that was born when it was a few, you know, couple months old. And like, I get chills about that. That was 4 or 5 years ago that I got to see that. And so that work is continuing today. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think back to the Gulf oil disaster as well. And, you know, the National Wildlife Federation has had a presence in the Gulf area because it's such a huge and important ecosystem, not only for the wildlife, but for people and the economies down there. And because we had a lot of folks on the ground down there, and again, working with affiliates in the Gulf states, we were able to help tell the story of what was actually happening on the ground and the wildlife story. And, you know, we've been very involved in the policy and end of things to make sure that the funds from that disaster that are actually going to be spent, the funds that came in as a result, the fines for that disaster, they're actually going to be spent on restoring the ecosystem. So that's another example of how the National Wildlife Federation works. But we're working in North Carolina with our affiliate there, the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, on the critically endangered red wolf. Now, everybody probably knows about gray wolves. This is what you think of when you say wolf. But we actually have a second species of wolf here in North America. And it almost went extinct. Back in the 70s, 80s, there were only a handful of these animals left. And the decision was made by biologists to actually catch the last remaining red wolves and bring them into captivity and put them into a captive breeding program because it was that dire. And mostly because we humans wiped them out. Prejudice, you know, anti-wolf sentiment, big bad wolf mythology, all of that kind of stuff, plus habitat destruction. And so at any rate, thankfully, because of zoo partners, you know, who had the skills and the knowledge and the science to set up these captive breeding programs, the red wolf was, you know, kind of saved from extinction, and enough of them were bred in captivity that wild releases started. And so the only population of this unique North American wolf species is now found in North Carolina at the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. And there's something like 20 of them, you know, varies from year to year. And they still face all those same problems. The other big challenge is interbreeding with coyotes. And so that's, you know, all ongoing. So I mention all that because it doesn't get a lot of spotlight, and it's a really amazing story of American wildlife. And the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, again, is boots on the ground in their state working on that. And the National Wildlife Federation is supporting those efforts. So just a handful of things that we're working on right now today across the country that involve affiliates and other partners across states. And again, we're America's Wildlife Organization.
Well, man, and you know, admittedly, you anticipated and answered the question that I was going to ask, in the sense of, you know, we oftentimes hear about, you know, these populations being decimated, whether it be the, you know, the bison or the red wolf or what have you. And, you know, to a layperson like me, the natural question becomes, okay, what do we do about it? Like, what even is step one? And it sounds like, you know, NWF and its affiliates already, you know, have experience helping, you know, various species become reintroduced and, you know, get back to a sustainable population level, that we already have like a bit of a loose roadmap, and it just takes tweaking that roadmap to the specific species.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because it's a perfect way to introduce something that I really want to talk about. And that is another really important piece of legislation that we're really trying to, you know, get passed, frankly, at the National Wildlife Federation, and that's the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. Now, you know, we talked a little bit ago about, you know, just how important policy and legislation is for getting conservation work done. You know, a lot of times you just can't rely on, you know, people doing the right thing, and you know, we have to have these, you know, these regulations in place to make sure that it happens. And we have a great proven track record of wildlife conservation in America. It's largely, though, focused on game species. So we have figured out the science behind maintaining good, healthy, strong populations of wildlife through our state wildlife agencies and hunting and fishing programs, which, you know, fund a lot of conservation work at the state level. And so, you know, we white-tailed deer, you know, are more numerous than they ever were on this continent, in part because of that, also spreading suburbia, which is really great deer habitat with no predators. But yeah, there's you know, waterfowl, you know, duck conservation, things like that, where we haven't really applied that knowledge, though, as much is to the non-game species. And so the Recovering America's Wildlife Act is this piece of legislation that, quite frankly, I think is incredible. So the idea behind this is, you know, the Endangered Species Act, really critical, important piece of wildlife legislation. But by its very nature, it's designed to help species that are really, really at the brink of extinction, right? That's why they're endangered. And when an animal or a species gets to that point, I mean, it's like putting them in an intensive care. It's really bad, and it's tough to get them off that list, right? And yet we've been able to do that with a lot of species, the bald eagle, the brown pelican, the peregrine falcon, depending on the population, gray wolves and things like that. So there's a lot of really great success stories. The American alligator actually is another great one, almost wiped out. And now today they're like showing up in people's backyards in Florida, right? That's because of the protections of the Endangered Species Act. Whales, you know, I grew up in the 80s and it was save the whales. And, you know, many of our whale species have recovered, at least in part. And some of them might even be delisted. I have to double check that. But at any rate, the Endangered Species Act is important, and it focuses on saving those species in critical condition. The Recovering America's Wildlife Act is meant to focus on species that are declining now, but aren't yet at that critical point, right? So we have an opportunity to apply what we know works in terms of restoring populations of game species to non-game species. And the idea behind this is that it's all based on existing funding. And if this passes, there's going to be $1.4 billion, again, of already money that already exists, that is going to go to the states. Every state has a state wildlife agency, and those state wildlife agencies have all put together wildlife action plans and have identified the species that are declining, some of which are declining rapidly in their states. And the Recovering America's Wildlife Act would fund those state-based wildlife conservation agencies, as well as tribes, to do that boots on the ground conservation work based on what we know already works. Literally the only missing piece is having the money to do it. And so that's what the Recovering America's Wildlife Act is all about. And just to give you some numbers, just to underscore how important this is, there are over 12,000 species here in the US that our state wildlife agencies have identified as in need of conservation help that are declining, some of which are declining rapidly. They're not endangered yet, so we have an opportunity to help them before they get to that critical point. And, you know, 12,000 species, one third of our wildlife in the US is at increased risk of extinction in the coming decades, based on what the state wildlife agencies know is going on the ground in their states, right? That doesn't get talked about a lot. We think about the wildlife extinction crisis and we think about, you know, Africa and Asia and other exotic places, but it's happening literally right in our own country, right in our own backyard sometimes. Look at the monarch butterfly, you know, is rapidly disappearing, right? So anyway, 12,000 species are rapidly declining, and these are the species that could, you know, will benefit if we can get the Recovering America's Wildlife Act passed.
So really what I'm hearing is it sounds like, you know, the Endangered Species Act, if Recovering America's Wildlife Act gets passed, almost kind of becomes a backstop for those 12,000 species that are declining. Recovering America's Wildlife Act seems to act as the preventative measure, and then you kind of have Endangered Species Act as the backup, where if it ever does get to that brink, we have an additional piece of legislation to kind of bolster those populations once more.
Yeah, I mean, there's this huge gap, this huge void in anything preventative, to use that term, before species get down to that point of being in such trouble that you have to go the route of the red wolf, which, you know, is a tremendous undertaking, a lot of money and time and years, decades to begin to turn things around, right? Whereas if we use the skills and knowledge that we already have right now with this additional funding, we can get the job done for many of those 12,000 species and help them when it's much easier to help them before they get to that critical point. And, you know, I think I mentioned the bill already has really fantastic bipartisan support. So again, when does that ever happen nowadays? So it's a feel good thing for me, because it really is a great example of how what we can do when we come together and we focus on that shared love of nature, that shared love of wildlife, that shared responsibility to ensure our natural heritage for future generations, right? That's not a partisan issue, or it shouldn't be. And that's what Recovering America's Wildlife Act is all about.
Exactly. And you know, in terms of talking about, you know, preventative measures, you know, of course, we're hopeful that the Recovering America's Wildlife Act gets passed and creates that funding for states to, you know, implement some preventative measures and help those species that are declining. But, you know, from an individual standpoint, you know, I was hoping I could get your thoughts on, you know, what are kind of some specific things that, you know, I can do just as, you know, a regular old Joe walking around the street to help kind of reduce my impact on our natural species?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's so many things that each of us can do. And one of the beauties is that there's no one right answer to that question, right? So I think for sure, we all have to be focused on that big picture, big, you know, kind of level effort, right? That's where the getting good policy passed, because that has such a huge umbrella effect that's where we see the real conservation gain. So how does the average person support that? Support your local wildlife conservation nonprofit, you know, whether it's a state organization like Indiana Wildlife Federation, a national organization like the National Wildlife Federation, so many great organizations out there doing really good work. And most of us are nonprofits, right? Like we're membership-based organizations. Your $20 membership is what keeps our doors open, right? It allows us to do this work to save America's wildlife. So that's a very simple thing that everybody can do, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. And if everybody does it, it really adds up. And I'll tell you, like, our budgets are never going to be what the budgets of the sort of the institutions and organizations and companies or whatever that are causing the harm, right? Exactly. So we're always going to be a David and Goliath situation. So even small contributions can really go a long way and helping, you know, sort of the good fight for wildlife. So that's something that everybody can do. Not everybody has the ability to make a financial donation, right? So I said this earlier too, let your voice be heard. And today with social media, I mean, there's just endless ways to be able to signal boost wildlife conservation messages. Create your own content, retweet us, you know? I mean, just get the word out, spread the word, tell other people about it. Tell people about the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. Challenge your neighborhood to all create gardens that are going to support local wildlife and get them certified as wildlife habitats, right? Like, we can do that kind of stuff, that very grassroots kind of thing. And again, you know, another great personal action is to create that wildlife garden. Make your own piece of the earth better for wildlife. Plant some native plants, stop spraying all the pesticides, that includes the mosquito sprays and all of that. You don't need that stuff. I don't have time to go into all the gory details on that, but maybe I can come back, you know, later and we can talk more all about mosquitoes and how to deal with them. I've written a bunch of blog posts about it as well. But so, you know, let your voice be heard, support conservation organizations, become members, you know, support our action opportunities, our action alerts to get policy and legislation passed, and to reach out to your elected officials and let them know as their constituent that you support wildlife and you want them to as well. Taking a hard turn, though, there's another really critically important thing that we can all do. And this goes back to the beginning of our conversation when you were asking about my background. Another area that the National Wildlife Federation focuses on, and it's really just so critical, is our work in the space of what we call kids in nature. And it's all centered around the idea, as we mentioned earlier, that, you know, kids, if they get the opportunity to go and have an experience in the natural world, they're much more likely to understand it and grow into adults that actually know why it's important to save this, you know, our wildlife and our natural heritage and that kind of thing. And so the National Wildlife Federation has been focused on getting kids in particular connected to nature for most of our history. So some of our listeners tonight might actually have grown up reading Ranger Rick magazine. I know I did, right? Ranger Rick is published by the National Wildlife Federation. And today we've got actually a whole bunch of Ranger Rick titles, Ranger Rick Cub and Ranger Rick Jr. And zoo books are now published underneath the Ranger Rick brand. I grew up reading those as well. So, you know, we're putting out educational content. We have school programs. The National Wildlife Federation is the U.S. partner in an international program called Eco Schools. And so we have a whole network of schools across the country that are greening themselves from, you know, their buildings and their curriculum and their energy use, you know, top to bottom. And we've got a schoolyard habitats program, which is the Garden for Wildlife idea, but done on a school ground and then used as an outdoor classroom. We got a ton of other programs that are designed to get kids connected to nature and families. We've got a whole campaign called Green Hour. This idea that an hour a day in nature is, you know, going to help with so many different things. And there's huge bodies of data that show the benefits, not just in developing a conservation ethic. The kids that get to go outside into nature, you know, they tend to be more physically fit. They have less problems with childhood obesity, but also things like it can help with kids that have attention deficit challenges. If you go outside and play, you're less likely to be vitamin D deficient. If you go outside and play, you are less likely to be nearsighted. So a lot of like health benefits to your kids about letting them run around and again, climb the tree and catch the frog. And of course it kind of feeds into introducing the next generation to the wonders of the natural world. And so that's something that all parents out there, all grandparents out there, and you know, for me, I have a niece and a nephew. I don't have my own kids. Like, that's, I always want to do create those experience for with them to help lay the groundwork. So that is something that, you know, everybody that has a kid in your life can do. Take them camping, go on a walk, do a nature scavenger hunt, you know, plant a flower garden in your backyard for the butterflies. Like, there's so many cool ways that you can get the kids involved.
Perfect. Well, yeah, and you know, like you said, going back to the beginning of our conversation, that's how I ended up with my passion. And oftentimes people will say National Wildlife Federation. And yes, you know, sometimes they say, is that the one with the panda? And I say, no, that's not the one with the panda, but have you ever been in a doctor's office and you see Ranger Rick? That is National Wildlife Federation. And yep. And yeah, my grandmother back when, you know, I was a very, very young kid, I think I had to have been 4 or 5 years old, and she got me my first Ranger Rick subscription, and she kept me on that subscription as long as she was alive. And I still remember flipping through those pages and looking at all the, you know, the beautiful wildlife, and it just inspiring me to want to go outside and see what I could find in my own backyard. So, yeah, you know,
the coolest thing on my first day, again, back in the year 2000 at the National Wildlife Federation, is walking into the building and seeing the Ranger Rick production wall, you know, with all the page layouts, you know, stuck up on the wall, and the editorial team working on it, laying out the art and the stories. And I was like, oh my God, I work here now. So,
oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, David, I cannot thank you enough for carving some time out of your busy schedule to be on the podcast today. You know, as we get ready to depart, where can the people find you?
Well, I'm all over social media. So if you can figure out how to spell my last name, Mizajewski, I'm D Mizajewski on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and TikTok. If you go to naturalist, www.nwf.org. That's my website. I'm on YouTube as well. You can get links to me on all of those places, or just Google my name and you'll find me. National Wildlife Federation, of course, is in all of those places. So, you know, that's, again, a simple to do. Everybody listening, if you go out right now and you follow the National Wildlife Federation, the Indiana Wildlife Federation on social media, follow me too, that would be great. That's a simple thing that you can do to get plugged in. And, you know, when you see us post stuff, share it. That really helps.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, you know, again, thank you so much, David. I really cannot express my appreciation. Whatever my expectations are or were for this conversation, you absolutely crushed them. I very much enjoyed this, and I look forward to talking to you next time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm happy to come back whenever. You can tell I like to talk about this stuff, so.
Well, hey, that makes two of us. I'll look forward to that conversation.
All right, sounds like a plan.
All right, well, thank you so much, David.
It is estimated that we have lost over 60% of our global wildlife population over the last 50 years, making the Indiana Wildlife Federation and its partners essential. As the state-authorized affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation, we work with over 50 affiliates across the country to protect, restore, and connect fragmented and degraded habitat across protected lands, working lands, waterways, coasts, and communities. Through conservation education, advocacy, and on-the-ground actions like habitat restoration and sustainable trail building, the Indiana Wildlife Federation is making a difference from Indiana's natural resources. Join or renew your membership today to support our work and help inspire the next generation of Hoosier conservationists. Visit us at www.indianawildlife.org to support.